well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Apologies for yesterday's unexpected, but not unexcused absence, power outage at my place, and the power did not come back on until after the sun was up Tuesday morning, and it was a sleepless night, Monday night slash into a Tuesday morning with dogs freaking out and all kinds of stuff. So anyway, apologies. I am back today. Glad to be with you behind the microphone. And as I talked about on Monday, you're going to hear from Cody J. Wisniewski of Firearms Policy Coalition's Action Foundation here in just a minute or two. You know, not long ago, the FPC released its recommendations to the Trump administration, what they would like to see from a pro-2A perspective. Not only in terms of rolling back, you know, the Biden era rules that were put in place under the ATF, but really how to move the ball forward in strengthening and securing our Second Amendment rights. So there are some really interesting recommendations. So very pleased that Cody could carve out a few minutes. We could sit down and talk about it. Take a look and a listen. Cody, thanks so much for coming to the program. It's good to see you again, sir.
Yes, sir. Happy to be here.
I am really glad that you're here, actually, because this proposed list of executive actions that FPC released just a few days ago after meeting with the White House, I think these are some really, really interesting agenda items. And, you know, I think it's pretty apparent to me that the Trump administration is now starting to become more active in looking at Second Amendment issues. I think there was a lot of frustration among gun owners at first, you know, because we had heard like, all right, it's going to be one of the first things we deal with. And we're waiting. And there was the executive action back in February. Robert Leiter named general counsel of the ATF. Like, there were some good things happening. But I think now we're starting to see big things happen, like the investigation of the L.A. Sheriff's Office, the Second Amendment Task Force that was announced by Pam Bondi. So I think it's a really good time for FPC to talk about what they want to see. So let me just ask, first of all, like, can you talk about that meeting that FPC had at the White House at all?
I can. FPC has already publicly stated that it happened.
Can you tell us who FPC met with at the White House?
I can tell you it happened. That I cannot. Okay. I do want to make one thing super clear. Obviously, so I'm president of FPC Action Foundation. I represent FPC as counsel. So I can, you know, talk about what FPC is doing and what's going on, what FPC has given me the green light to talk about. I can say that the White House has been very receptive, and that FPC has, you know, put together some information for the White House, put together some positions and some things that, you know, should draw specific attention. I can also say that, you know, we are actively working on putting stuff together, as in I took a pause from doing some legal analysis to hop on with you just now. So there is a lot going on. I think, you know, we talk a lot about how slow the gears of litigation are and how courts are. Government's definitely a little bit faster, but not much. And so I think that's part of it. I think part of the reason that it's, you know, April and we're seeing big announcements now is just that government is big and does too much. But as a result, there's a lot of things going on. So it, you know, I'm pretty comfortable in saying that, like, the administration and appointees are taking a very close look at Second Amendment issues, at gun rights issues generally. And we're, you know, obviously seeing good things come out of that examination and our, you know, FPC's discussions with the administration. So trending in the right direction. Still things to do, still things to cover. Obviously, FPC's, you know, targeted some specific focuses and changes, some of which the administration has already announced that it's moving towards, and others that, you know, kind of remain open.
Okay. That is good to know, I think, you know, all of what you just said. And you know, let me say, I mean, listen, there's a lot of things, there are a lot of moving parts right now, right? I mean, we just saw Kash Patel, actually, I guess we don't really know when Kash Patel stopped being the acting director of the ATF. There seems to be some open discussion about that, but Dan Driscoll is now the acting head of the ATF. Marvin Richardson, the deputy director, apparently resigned. Larry Keene from NSSF said that there are a number of other senior ATF officials who have apparently agreed to early retirement. They're taking the government's offer. So, you know, that agency alone, I think, is in flux. And it's going to be really interesting what the administration does in terms of filling these vacant positions that have now suddenly become open. And Dan Driscoll is still the acting director. He's also the current Secretary of the Army. So, you know, we'll see how long he's in that position, whether Trump, you know, nominates a permanent director or somebody else. So with all of that being said, let's talk about some of the things that the FPC said that they would like to see. And, you know, again, you talk about all of this stuff being in flux and government doing too much. So the first thing that FPC talked about was establishing a Second Amendment czar, somebody who could, you know, serve as that sort of central coordinating point throughout all these federal agencies, and maybe a point of consistency, right? So that when you do have this turnover and this churn that you're going to expect when, you know, the swamp is being drained, so to speak, that you've got that individual or maybe that team there in place to ensure that there's a consistent pro-Second Amendment policy going on.
Yes. Yeah, think of it as like quality control for everything Second Amendment related, right? It's a person who, it would be a person who has extensive experience in the area, who knows the issues, who is aware of the interplay between things, is aware of kind of the landscape of Second Amendment regulation, Second Amendment laws, and the issues, you know, following from those, and somebody who can then kind of put in place consistent positions both up and down, right? Specific recommendations up the ladder, and then implementation of specific policy decisions down the ladder. I think one of the problems that we see a lot with firearms regulation is just that so many things are intertwined and interregulated. Different definitions between Gun Control Act and National Firearms Act, mm-hmm. you know, different terms used one way when referring to suppressors and silencers, and a different way when referring to, you know, firearms or frames and receivers, right? Like, these things are all interrelated. And then there's another whole side of this when you start talking about importation, when you start talking about, you know, subsection R and all of these other issues. So you really need somebody in there that understands the issues and can translate them up the ladder in a way that makes it make sense to the administration so it can set policy and then can take that policy and implement it down ladder. And I think that's really, really important when you're talking about such a technical area, because the government has its hands in so many different parts of it, such a highly regulated space, right? It's obviously a very highly regulated industry and something that needs to be addressed consistently. But also somewhere where we've seen the government just repeatedly infringe, right? Like, it's somewhere that the federal government has not, it's an issue that the federal government has not been good on for a long time, partly because of administrations, partly because of, you know, Trump was in the White House for 4 years before and there was some stuff then. And so that is, you know, a major part of it as well, is just, it's an opportunity for the federal government to get better on this issue area mm-hmm. and to actually put forward, you know, policy and positions that advocate for Second Amendment protected rights. And that's, at the end of the day, the natural right that is protected by the Second Amendment is the most important part of all of this. And so you need staunch advocates of that right.
Which I think segues nicely into the second recommendation that FPC listed, which is this dedicated, you know, team within the Civil Rights Division that would focus on things like that LA Sheriff's Department investigation and the policies and practices of issuing concealed carry licenses, which I think is great. And, you know, I wholeheartedly agree. I am curious, though, because the actual recommendation was for a section that would deal with First and Second Amendment issues. And FPC talks about, you know, going after these violations of unconstitutional laws, including free speech and the right to keep and bear arms. So I think of FPC as a single issue organization. I'm just curious, Cody, as to why. I don't disagree at all. I'm just curious as to why FPC said, you know what? No, we need to focus on this issue, too, in addition to our right to keep and bear arms.
Yeah. So interestingly, I mean, obviously, we're FPC's Firearms Policy Coalition.
Right.
Obviously, the vast majority of our litigation is addressing gun rights issues, Second Amendment claims. FPC is a single issue organization, but the single issue is maximal human liberty. If you look at our mission statement, if you look at our shared mission statement at FPC Action Foundation, our focus is maximal human liberty. Today, that means gun rights. That, you know, I, the way that I always explain it is that, you know, firearms are kind of the microcosm of the macrocosm. If you can do this to gun rights, to the natural right to self-defense, then down the road, what else are you able to do when it comes to speech and when it comes to privacy and when it comes to, you know, trials and everything else? And so while we are focused on and experts in gun rights and those issues, we care a lot about all constitutionally protected rights, all natural rights, life, liberty, property, pursuit of happiness, the entire list. That's our issue. We just specialize in Second Amendment and gun rights issues right now. That being said, even with that, right, there are so many things that are tied up within the First Amendment that also impact people who are in our space, right? It's not just free speech, just generally speaking, being able to advocate and you know, fight for your rights or speak about your rights, right? You have all of the cases dealing with code, right? That comes in under First Amendment as well. Mm-hmm. You have the right to association, which is protected under the First Amendment, which is hugely important. People's ability to connect together to become members of FPC so that we can, as one, advocate for, you know, talk to the White House. We can litigate, you know, do those things. That's all incredibly important as well. And of course, we sue the government. So we are perpetually petitioning
that redress or grievance.
No, and those are all hugely important to our issue as well.
I think that's a fantastic explanation. And again, you know, the idea of promoting maximal liberty. Now, I will say, if we ever secure our gun rights and the focus ever shifts, you guys might need to think about a name change because the Firearms Policy Coalition might not be the best fit. Maybe you add something to it, the Firearms Policy and Free Speech Coalition or something like that. All right. So the last agenda item, enact massive National Firearms Act reforms, a comprehensive review and modernization initiative to remove or update outdated rules and processes. Can't change the statutory language, but you can change the rules and interpretations, increase access to NFA regulated arms, speed processing with point of purchase processing and virtually instant background check responses, among other things. Again, I don't think you're going to get, I mean, okay, there are going to be some gun owners who are going to push back because there are some gun owners push back on everything. But I don't think you're going to get a lot of pushback to that from the Second Amendment community. I am curious, though. Have you gotten any pushback from people who are asking, well, why didn't you just advocate for abolishing the ATF? Why didn't you just, you know, advocate for ignoring the NFA? Have you had that reaction at all?
Not that I have seen. Okay. That being said, anybody who follows me on social media is well aware that I am not active on social media. Obviously, the FPC team is, and you know, the organization
is quite active,
quite
popular. I will say.
So it's very possible that the guys are seeing something that I'm not. What I would say is, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for the agency to bind itself to things, right? Everybody talks about what the government can do on top of what it's already doing, right? And that's, every time you talk about new administrations, for some reason, everybody talks about like, okay, well, we can do more. We're going to enact all of these new policies. But the two things that never really come up is first, get rid of stupid stuff. So there's plenty of opportunity to, you know, shred the Federal Register on your way out the door, right? Like you can fix a lot of things because if you just abolish the ATF tomorrow, let's say, like that's on the table, ATF's abolished tomorrow, all of those regulations are still on the books, and ATF just operates under Department of Justice as it is today. And so all that's really going to happen is all of that same stuff is going to still be in place, and DOJ is just going to have the authority because all that is going to happen is any delegation that's happened down to ATF is just going to be nullified. And then everything will be under the power of DOJ. So nothing changes.
Right.
The other side is government can use its power to bind itself to do things, right? They can put in a regulation that says that they have to process, you know, different forms within a week if they wanted to, right? They can bind themselves and set themselves to specific timelines and then create redress for if they fail to stick to those timelines. Like, these are all things that you can do in order to provide protection for people before you burn an agency down.
Right? Yeah.
There's plenty of things to do on the way out the door.
Right. You know, and it's interesting because, again, I mean, and I think that providing for a redress of abuses is really important, because what we see a lot of times, you know, California, what on paper, they're supposed to process concealed carry applications in, I think it's 120 days, right? Yeah. But when the LA Sheriff's Department takes 2 years, nothing happens to the LA Sheriff's Department, right? So, you're right. This is an opportunity to write some regulations. And I like, again, the way you talk about it, binding the government to itself, making the government live up to its word, and fulfilling its duties. And if it doesn't fulfill its duties, then it's not just, what are you going to do about it? Right. But there is something we can do about it. And again, I'm really glad to hear that the White House has received these ideas positively. Again, this is an opportunity, I think, to, as you say, not just undo what was done over the past 4 years, but really put in place some reforms that hopefully, you know, will be with us for years to come, right? And can benefit gun owners, for generations to come.
Yeah. Yeah. And the end of this is all, you know, from my perspective, the important thing here is just putting in place things that respect the constitutionally protected right. Right. All of this is about ensuring that abuses are rectified. And that is the biggest problem, right? I mean, so many of these policies, these procedures are just blatantly unlawful or blatantly unconstitutional. It doesn't take, you know, a rocket scientist to see that most of the time. But it is also it's a very big world. There's a lot of things that are regulated. The government has expansive power and authority over a billion different subject matters. And so, you know, what's important for us and important is to be able to point out, these are the things that are unlawful. These are the things that are unconstitutional. You know, this is a lawful way to move forward, or this is a constitutional way to move forward. And I think that's, you know, the biggest point, and being able to get to a place where people, I mean, again, maximal human liberty. At the end of the day, that's the goal. Are we going to get there tomorrow? No. But anything that we can do to get to that end state is incredibly important.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Cody, listen, we're going to let you get back to work because, I appreciate you taking a few minutes, but I want you to get back to that legal analysis, which will benefit all of us as gun owners. So again, thanks very much for your time. I know we're going to do this again in the future, but always love having you on the show.
Absolutely, sir. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. And I'll get back to it.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, Cam.
And thanks once again to Cody for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again here before long. And who knows, maybe next time we'll have some news about Snope to talk about. I'm not holding my breath, but hope springs eternal, I guess. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report there. We'll start there with the case out of Cincinnati. The headline, records reveal lengthy criminal history of teen accused in deadly shooting. So last weekend, a 25-year-old named Kyle Myrick was shot and killed in Cincinnati outside of a liquor store not far from the campus of the University of Cincinnati. Surveillance video shows a suspect walking up to Myrick, shoving him, then pulling out a gun. Myrick turns around, starts to run away. Myrick had a gun on him and did try to fire at his assailant. The assailant fired as well, and Myrick passed away at the hospital. Cincinnati police report a 15-year-old has been charged with murder, also charged with one count of aggravated murder, one count of aggravated robbery, one count of carrying a concealed weapon. As it turns out, this 15-year-old, no stranger to the criminal justice system, identified in court papers only by his initials since he is being charged as a juvenile right now, DM, has 16 previous charges on his record, dating back to when he was just 13 years old. Most serious charge of which aggravated assault. Now, again, this is 2 years, right? So 16 charges in 2 years, including aggravated assault, attempted grand theft, theft, violations of his probation. And the head of the local FOP in Cincinnati says if the juvenile justice system was functioning the way it should be, DM would not have been out on the streets, but instead would have been in custody, and Mr. Myrick would be alive today. But instead, as we see all too often in juvenile cases, serious offenses don't lead to serious consequences. And the role of the juvenile justice system is not incarceration, right? It is primarily rehabilitation. But there still needs to be supervision. There still needs to be an actual program that is designed to help and has a track record of helping to rehabilitate youthful offenders. Otherwise, what is the point of slapping a ankle monitor on somebody after they've been convicted of a serious crime, telling them to check in with the probation officer once a month, don't do drugs, mind your curfew, and then if nothing happens, they violate their probation, and nobody really seems to care? What message does that send? To me, it sends the message that, the courts don't really care. That all this tough talk about consequences really is just a lot of hot air. And it can be ignored with impunity. And sadly, I think we see that in case after case dealing with the young offenders. Don't know for sure if that was on DM's mind. But again, it sounds like the state of Ohio had every opportunity, and Hamilton County in particular, had every opportunity to ensure that this murder suspect was not on the streets, but failed to do so. Today's armed citizen story from South Carolina, and this is kind of breaking news. It actually happened overnight, so we don't have a Monday night. So we don't have a ton of information, but we should learn more. This was in Georgia, Butts County. Sheriff Gary Long says Monday night a man identified as Abdul Akil broke a window at a home there outside of a child's bedroom and then tried to gain entry to the home. Butts said the father of the child, quote, challenged the intruder, and the suspect exited the window. Now, that challenge involved getting a gun and shooting at the man trying to break in. According to the sheriff, the shot fired by the homeowner was unfortunately, that's the words of the sheriff there, unfortunately about 8 inches too high, missing the intruder, which would have resulted in his death. The suspect did take off running, however, apparently no longer trying to gain entry to the home. And according to Gary Long, deputies found and took Akil into custody after a quote, brief altercation. He's now been charged with burglary, home invasion, terroristic threats, first-degree cruelty to children, second-degree criminal damage to property, as well as obstruction of law enforcement. And the sheriff of Butts County, Gary Long, says to the citizens, if you are legally allowed to possess a firearm, I strongly encourage each and every one of you to obtain one. Attend our class, and let us help you protect your family. If the homeowner last night was not a gun owner, I'm afraid the outcome could have been much different. Sheriff Long went on to say to the criminals, listen up and pay close attention. If you decide to break into a home in Butts County, make sure you are ready to meet your maker. My staff and I will spend as much time as it takes to make sure the citizens of this county are well-trained, educated, and capable of making great shots to protect their family and homes. So unless you are prepared to die, I would highly recommend you find a home in another county to burglarize, because this is not the one. I got to say, I like that sheriff. I like the cut of his jib. All right, on to today's good deed of the day in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing from Largo, Florida, where a good Samaritan helped save a stabbing victim at a smoke shop in the city. This was, I believe, over the weekend. Monday again, just before noon. Officers from the Largo Police Department arrived at this smoke shop. They got a call about a stabbing. They found the victim, a man named Dafir Muhammad Dalek, as well as the suspect, 22-year-old Yesenia Sofia Gonzalez-Alega, both there still on the scene. Dalek, obviously suffering from injuries, whereas Gonzalez-Alega was being held down by a good Samaritan, allowing police to take her into custody. Officers rendered aid to Dalek until paramedics arrived. He was taken to a local hospital with what's described as serious injuries. Authorities reviewed the store surveillance footage. They say it shows Gonzalez Alega entering the store, asking Dalek for something that's on the lower shelf. He turns around, bends down to grab it, and police say that's when she grabbed a knife from her purse and began stabbing Dalek. Now, they don't know what the motivation was here. They say that the two did not know each other before this incident. So this was just a random person walking into this store and then randomly stabbing the clerk behind the counter. Thankfully, Dalek is expected to make a full recovery. Gonzalez Alega arrested, charged with first-degree attempted murder. The Good Samaritan, unharmed, apparently. And, you know, in that moment, putting himself at risk of being stabbed, but doing so, again, to save the life of that individual behind the counter. We don't know the name of that Good Samaritan. Don't know that we ever will. But in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. And I would say, too, another... just like Sheriff Long was talking about, another situation where, you know, being armed for self-defense would have been helpful, right? I'm not to take anything away from the Good Samaritan's actions, but if the Good Samaritan could have ended that threat standing several feet away rather than having to tackle somebody with a knife, I would prefer that outcome. Regardless, in this case, the Good Samaritan, not injured. The victim is expected to recover, and the suspect is in custody. Because somebody put others before themselves, was in the right place at the right time, and willing and able to do the right thing. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow as we once again talk about some of the big 2A news from around the country. Between now and then, though, don't forget to check out BearingArms.com. We're keeping you up to date, again, on everything going on. Court systems, state houses, up on Capitol Hill. We got you covered, including a new number two at the ATF. Wrote about that this morning. Firearms industry pretty excited about having somebody with a good relationship and somebody who knows about going after violent criminals in place as the new deputy director. All right, we'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.